let's just we leave the renormalization theory. We'll come back next week. And today I am coming back to functional integration, but I will address the problem of fermions. Because up to now, we have discussed how to quantize using path integral method and functional integrals a scalar field, so a field which describes bosons. And there are very specific problems when you are trying to deal with fermions. So let us recall what I think you have seen in the QFT 1 course, which is how you deal in first in canonical quantization. You quantize the Dirac field. Remember that in the first quantization, you have an electron is described by a spinor, a psi field, which obey the Dirac equation minus I d slash minus m of psi equals zero. This is Dirac equation. And of course, I will use the standard notation. So I am in Minkowski space. So the metric H mu nu is minus 1, 1, 1, 1. That's my notation. You have the psi and the Dirac is a field with component psi alpha, with alpha going from 1 to 4. So that's the Dirac indices. So in the Dirac theory psi, you see the wave function of the electron is in fact, there are four wave functions which are complex functions which are associated to 4 degrees of freedom of the fermions, which are related to the fact that you have a spin. And of course, what's very important are the Dirac matrices, gamma alpha, gamma mu, the Dirac matrices, which satisfy the anti-commutation relation, gamma mu, equal, and with my notation, I've got a minus 2 H mu nu, because my metric is minus the metric that you used in the QFT1 course. So these are the same Dirac matrices. Okay, and of course, you know that this means D slash, the operator D slash is just gamma mu D mu. So it's a matrix. The Dirac matrices are 4 by 4 matrices in 4 dimensions. And so the D slash operator is a differential operator, but it is a matrix differential operator. So it acts on the Dirac wave function and maps it into another Dirac wave function. So everything is consistent. Okay. And you have seen that. So this is basically the receipt for doing first quantization of particle. And when you are doing a second quantization, this becomes an operator. So psi of x becomes an operator. So let us write it like so. It becomes an operator acting on the Fock space H of fermions. So it becomes a big operator. And you have seen that in order to have a theory which is consistent for fermions, those operators has to anti-commute. So if you consider in space-time, this is time, this is space, 2 points which are time separated, x and y, 2 events which are space-like separated. In fact, the field operator at point x and the field operator at point y have to anti-commute. and they satisfy, if they are time-like separated, anti-commutation relation instead of commutation relation. And that's, of course, because of the spin statistics theorem. Yes?
How does the anti-commutation relate to the way in which X and Y are separated?
The way in which?
X and Y are separated.
Oh, that's because they anti-commute if they are space-like separated, and if they are time-like separated, then this is, of course, different from zero. Exactly like in ordinary quantum mechanics. But if they are space-like separated, this means that it's just because of causality. It means that, you know, applying an operator to a state of the theorem, in some sense, it's like making a measurement. It's doing something on the field. And if, because of causality, if the two points where you are making two separate operations on your state, if they are space-like separated, you can first apply your operation here and then do something here, or do it in the opposite way. Otherwise, you would have a lot of problem with causality. It means that you can send a signal which goes faster than light. And you have a lot of problem. Okay? And so it's already the case if you have bosonic field. Simply, if you have a bosonic field, the field operator are bosonic operator and they commute. So the difference, the point with fermions is that they anti-commute. Okay. So you could say that if they anti-commute, it means that you can send signal, but in fact not. So it's not really a problem. Okay. So so the question is, this was obtained by canonical quantization. And the question is, can we do that by functional integral method? And it's not just a mathematical question. It's because we know how to quantize fields involving scalars by functional integral method. Next week, we shall see that it's possible up to some technical points, which are important but technical, that you can quantize by functional method gauge fields, which are also bosons because they are spin one field. But if you cannot quantize in the same way fermions, then we are in trouble when we try to do physics, because we know in the real world, even in quantum electrodynamics, we have both fermions and the gauge field. And so the question is, how can we devise functional integral methods where the basic subjects that we have to consider anti-commute instead of commutes? We cannot use just ordinary numbers. And the solution to that is to use to change the rule of the calculus, and to use, instead of using anti-commuting number, I will show you first how to use anti-commutings. Numbers. And this is a piece of math which is called as Bayesian calculus, because it was first devised by a mathematical physicist and a mathematician, a Russian mathematician in the 60s, whose name is Bayesian. And so, so forget a little bit now at the moment about what is a Dirac field, what is a fermions, and let us just try to define what are anti-commuting numbers. So remember, if we use the typical use of commuting numbers are complex numbers. And so you have the real numbers, but the typical number, and real numbers. And for instance, we always are manipulating complex number, and when doing Gaussian integrals, we are Gaussian integrals over, for instance, complex number. Or, so we can consider real number too, but I will consider only an anti-commutative generalization of complex number. Okay. So, I will just do some formalism. I define the analog of what is a complex number, but a number which is anti-commuting. So I consider, I will consider a set of n numbers that I call theta I. I goes from 1 to n. Okay, and then I consider their conjugate theta bar I equal 1 to n, which are the conjugates of the theta I. So it's the same thing that considering that you have a family of n I complex number and you have their complex conjugate. You see? And I have a family of n such numbers. And I want to make calculus out of those n numbers. And this will be what is called Grassmann numbers. With two n. The name of the mathematician who started to discuss. And so they are considered as generators, just generators of an algebra that I will call GN that I built out of the thetas and the theta i's. You see? And this algebra, which will be the generalization of the algebra of functions of complex numbers, you see. So let me first define first how I can multiply those numbers. So the rule is simply that for any of those numbers, any numbers, anti-commutes, any numbers, the thetas or theta bars, anti-commutes. You see? So this means that I have a multiplication in this algebra, but this multiplication is such that theta I, theta g plus theta g, theta I equals zero, and the same for theta bar I, theta bar G, plus theta bar G, theta bar E, equals zero, and the same for theta I, theta bar G, plus theta bar G, theta E equals zero, etc. For any I and G. So I have objects, I consider them as numbers, but I multiply them. But when I multiply them, they are always this property, you see? So just see that as a rule of calculus. Of course, this implies that theta I squared equals zero. Theta G, theta bar I squared equals zero. So those numbers, the square of any such numbers is zero. Which it simplifies a lot the calculation, of course, because if you have a number and each time you you multiply a number by itself, it's zero, it makes things much simpler. Strange, but simpler. Okay? So these are the generators of the algebra. Now, what is the a general number. What is a general element G of the algebra, this algebra Gn? Okay, so it is defined just by a sum of products of this number. So in fact, it's simply defined by, for instance, G equal. So a number is simply a sum of products of theta, theta, theta bar, with some coefficient in front of it, which is just a complex number. So you take any linear combination of products of thetas and theta bars. And you define that this is the element of the algebra. So the algebra is made out of all these objects. You see? So example, to see it sounds very abstract, but example, the simplest example, the one-dimensional algebra. This algebra is called the Grassmann algebra, by the way. Grassmann algebra, because it was introduced in mathematics by a mathematician called Grassmann before Bérezin. But Bérezin used it to do quantum theory. Okay, so example, n equal 1, so you have just two numbers, theta and theta bar. They anticommute. And a general element of the algebra is of the form. So you may have no thetas and theta bar. So this is an A. You can have one theta, B. You can have one theta bar, C. And you have a product, theta and theta bar. Okay, so the A, B, C, D are complex numbers. You see? And you see, that's it, because you could say, okay, I could write also a theta bar theta, but remember, the rules are theta squared equals zero, theta bar squared equals zero, and theta theta bar equals minus theta bar theta. These are the by rule of calculation. You see? Okay. And then you can define calculus. For instance, you can multiply two numbers using this rule of calculation. And I will do, for instance, if you have a G1, which is given by such a number, as you have G prime, which is given by A prime plus B prime theta, plus C prime theta bar, plus D prime theta and theta bar, I can multiply G prime. And I found, if you do a little bit of calculation, you find A prime. You find the term of order theta are A prime B plus A B prime theta. The term of order theta bar are A C prime plus A prime C. And the interesting thing which appears is the term theta theta bar. Because when you multiplied G by G prime, you have a theta theta bar which comes from this terms times this term. So you have a B C prime. You have a term which comes from multiplying this by this. But if you multiply this by this, you have a theta times theta. You have a, here you had a theta times theta bar. Here you have a theta bar times theta, which is minus theta times theta bar. So you get a minus B prime C. You see? And then you get these terms times these terms, and these terms times these terms, which gives you AD prime plus A prime D. And that's it. All the other terms multiply theta by this is zero because theta squared is zero. You see? Okay, so this seems some quite strange rule of calculus, but they are perfectly consistent. In fact, this algebra, G, N, is what is called an associative algebra in mathematics, but it is non-commutative. So it contains part of the element of the algebra commutes, part do not commute, you see. So it contains, so the generators of the algebra anti-commutes, and out of the generators, you build a set of numbers which sometimes commute, sometimes anti-commute. Yes?
So in this G, this formula of D.
Yes?
When you write it in terms of C, theta.
Yes?
You put the lot of theta.
Yes.
Yes,
you consider them as they are generators. So they are different.
May I say that they are not saying theta, but they are theta I, theta I, theta I.
Yes.
They are different.
I am not sure I understand your point.
Are these theta?
Yeah, no. Oh, here those theta are different. You have different theta I. So you have a theta I 1 up to a theta I. K and a theta G1 up to a theta GL, and you may have different number. And here you have a coefficient which depend of I, of all the I's and all the G, and you in all possible numbers. So here you are very simple because you can have either one theta or one theta bar or two theta bar, or it can be different. Okay. Okay. So these are the rules of the game, but then it's not enough. So you see, you may consider a general element algebra as a function of the generator, exactly in the same way that in the case of a complex number, a function of Z I and Z bar G of all the Z's and the Z bar can be expanded in a sum of products of Z I, Z, Z bar, Z bar with some coefficient of the Taylor expansion. But simply here you may have Z I 1 to the, so Z 1 to some power N 1 up to Z N some power nn, etc. And you cannot do that in your Grassmann algebra because the Taylor expansion, if you want, stops at first order in any of the variables. You see, so this is a functions. Z, Z bar in ordinary calculus. And in this Grassmannian calculus, all Taylor expansions stopped at first order in any variable. See, so, yes? Pardon?
Is it possible to still do Taylor expansion?
No, it's not really a Taylor expansion. You can view it as a Taylor expansion, but be a bit careful because, in the ordinary Taylor expansion, G is also a complex number, you see. While here, G is an element of the algebra, but you are not expressing an element of the algebra. It's not a function. It's a function of some very specific element of the algebra, which are the generator. You see? So it's a bit, it's an analogy, but it's not completely exact. Okay, So, but since we have the analog of functions, we can define on this algebra of strange numbers, we can define three operations. First, we can define what's the analog of the complex conjugation. Okay. We have seen in some sense that theta and theta bar are the analog of z and z bar. But we have to define what is the complex conjugation of a general number. So what is we want to define if we have a number g, an element of g algebra, what is this complex conjugate that we'll call g star? That's the mathematical notation for complex conjugation. I call it g star to distinguish it for the bar which is there. Okay? So the rules are quite simple. The rules is that, you see, the numbers are made out of complex numbers and of the generators theta and theta bar. So you have to define what is, for a complex number, what is the complex conjugate of a complex number? And of course, it will just be the ordinary conjugation. You see? So star is the conjugation in the algebra. And bar here is the conjugation, the ordinary complex conjugation in the C. Now, if you have a theta I, it's quite natural to assume that the complex conjugate of theta I star is theta I bar. And similarly, the conjugate of a theta bar is theta I. Okay? But now we have to define what is the natural definition of the conjugation of a product of theta and theta bar? See? And the rule is that, in general, if you have two G1, if you have two elements of the algebra, I define the conjugate of the products of two elements of the algebra to be the inverted product of the conjugate, you see? And that's a natural definition because it's the analogous of the transpose for matrices or of the complex conjugation for complex matrices, you see? When you have objects we do not commute like matrices, the complex conjugation for matrices obeys this rule. The complex conjugate, the conjugate transpose of a product of two matrices is the inverse product of the complex transpose of those matrices. So it's exactly the same rule than for matrices. And for matrices. But we are not dealing with an algebra of matrices. We are dealing with a different algebra, which is this Grassmann algebra. Okay? And you see, for instance, with this definition that if you have theta I, theta g, and I want to compute its conjugate, it will be theta g bar times theta I bar, for instance, okay? Since the example. But it tells you also what is the conjugate of several other products, okay? Good. So now, something slightly more more subtle. We will to define what is a derivation and integration. We want to define what is, so you can view the G as some function of the generators. So we'd like to define what are the derivation and integration with respect to the generators theta I and theta bar I. In the same way that we know what is the derivative of a function with respect to a variable Z. And we know what is the integration of a function with respect to variable z. Because that's what we will need. Okay? And for that, remember, any element of the algebra depends on a theta in a very simple way, in the decomposition term. Either there is no theta, or there is one theta. There cannot be two thetas. So you only need to define what is the derivative with respect to theta I of 1, and what is the derivative with respect to theta I of another theta I. And I take that this is 0, and I define this to be 1, as usual. So the derivation, you know, kills a theta if there is a theta. And if there is no theta, it gives 0. I define in the same way the derivation with respect to theta I bar. I bar of theta bar I equal 1. And it is quite natural that, in fact, to define that if this is a G different from I, this is 0. So this is a delta IG. Okay? Also, I can define that d over d theta of theta bar g is always 0. And d over d theta bar I of any theta g is always 0. The derivative of a theta bar with respect to a theta is 0. Okay? And now, I am interested from these rules in defining what is the derivative with respect to a theta I of some g, a g of this form. And the rule is the same. It's first move theta I to the left so that you can write g as g0 plus theta I g1. You see, so any element contains either no theta I or one theta I. Using the anti-commutation relation, you can always move it to the left. Okay? And then you apply the rules. You said that d over theta I of this is 0. D over d theta I of theta I g1 is g1. So by definition, this is g1. And remember, this is something which do not contain the theta I. This is something which do not contain the theta I. So those are the elements. Those elements do not contain theta I, because you see the idea. Okay? And the same for d over d theta bar I. And using this relation, you can check that, as you could expect, the d over d theta and the d over d theta bar anti-commutes. The theta and the theta bars are anti-commuting variables. The derivations anti-commutes. You see? So, for instance, d over d theta I, d over d theta g, plus d over d theta g times d over d theta I is always equal to 0. The same if you have theta and theta bars. Okay? So, you have a derivation. It's the same rule that the ordinary derivation, except that you have to remember that when you take the derivative of an element of the algebra, you have to look where the theta I is and put it to the left before applying this. And once you know that, you know how to compute. You see? So, for instance, in this case, you see immediately that d over d theta of g, in my example, of this example, d over d theta g of g is b plus d theta bar. But d over d theta bar of g is c minus d theta. theta, because you have first have to anti-commute the theta and the theta bar before applying the theta bar. You see? Okay, so this is for derivation. Derivation. Now, what about integration? Well, it starts to be a bit different, a bit more abstract. Basically, integration will be something which looks, will be defined like integrating a function of a complex variable, an analytic function of a complex variable around a closed loop. You see, so. We want to define an integration that I will define d over d theta I with the property that d over d theta I of d over theta I is always equal to zero. So the integral of a derivation is always to zero. So it's just the rule of integration by part. Applied to some strange number and where there are no boundaries. So you always integrate neglecting the boundary terms. Yes?
A few questions. One is the integral of derivative of anything in particular? Is anything
yes, no, it means that this means that apply to any, I want to define an operation of integration such that if I integrate a number which is a derivative of something, I always get zero. Okay, so if you want, this means that this of any g equals zero for any g belonging to spy Grassmann algebra. You see? Because you know that if you integrate where g is an analytic function, and if I integrate over a closed contour in the z-plane, this is always equal to zero. Well, if it's an analytic function, it's obvious, but even if it's a meromorphic function, or even if it has pole, the integral of a derivative is zero, because this is simply g of zero, well, g of, let us say, one minus g of zero, if you integrate from zero to one, but if zero and one are the same, this is a two, you see. Okay? But, well, it's just an, here again, it's an analogy.
Why shouldn't the Grassmann algebra be like integrating around a closed loop where there is no boundary condition, or where there is no boundary term?
Yes.
Why should that characterize?
Well, sometimes it's interesting, you know, when you, sometimes it's non-zero for a general function. If the function is analytic, it's even if the function is non-analytic. Take any function, I'm sorry. Take any function, something like that. It doesn't need to be analytic. It's just because it's g of the origin minus the g of, well, g of the origin minus g of the endpoint, because that's the rule of integration by part. Okay. But it's just an analogy. I will need an operation of integration which satisfies this rule. And we do have it, because remember, derivative anti-commutes. So in particular, applying a derivative to a derivative gives always zero. So integration, we can choose that integral d theta I equals simply d over d theta I. And integral over d theta I bar equals d over d theta I bar. So take it as a definition. So you see, In this, so this was a definition of what a derivation is, together with the initial condition. And but this, okay, and this is a definition of an integration. So you see, if you want to define an integration over Grassmann numbers, it's exactly the same thing that the derivative. So it's a bit strange, but it's mathematically perfectly consistent. Okay? And in particular, you check very easily that integral over d theta of 1 is 0, while integral over d theta of theta is 1. So these are quite strange rules. If you start to think about what is an integration, it obeys rules which seems to be a bit opposite to what's happening for ordinary calculus. You see? Okay. So, but for the moment, these are rules of calculus. So I have introduced an algebra of some numbers, which are an algebra which is generated by anti-commuting numbers, theta and the theta. I have defined how I multiply those objects. I have defined what is a complex conjugation. I will need it later on. It's a complex algebra. And I define what is a what are derivation with respect to some of the generators, and what is the integration with respect to the generators. Okay? That's mathematics. For the moment, it's just pure formal mathematics. But we'll see why this is very useful to do physics. So first, now let me, with those numbers, try to do Gaussian integrals. Over Grassmann numbers. Okay? Yes?
So before you go, what is the range for the Grassmann number and what is the upper bound and the lower bound for the
integral? What is the? There is no upper bound. It's an abstract integration, it's an operation that I call integration, but it's completely abstract. There are no bounds. So forget about that, which is for, forget about that, which is something which is valid for ordinary numbers. The integration over complex numbers, over Grassmann numbers, have no bound. It's just a symbol of an operation that I called integration. You see? But we will see that it has nice properties of integration. Okay? Okay, so now from that, let us consider what are Gaussian integrals. Okay, so what is, let us first do it for n equal 1. Okay? Let me take a real number or complex number. Okay, and I want to define what is the exponential of minus theta bar a theta. This is the number of the algebra. So in order to do that, I just expand the exponential. So this is 1 minus theta bar a theta plus nothing, because the second term contains 2 theta bar and 2 theta. So the Taylor expansion of the exponential in the algebra with one generator is just stops at first order. You see? And then what is, so I can rewrite this, of course, as 1 plus a theta theta bar using the anti-commutation relation. You see? And now, if I want to compute the integral over theta bar times the integral over theta of this number, A theta. I apply my rule. First, I integrate over theta 1 gives 0. This gives A theta bar. So this is the integral over theta bar of A theta bar. So this is A. You see? Okay. So now let me do this for n equal 2. I take now by A a 2 by 2, let us say, for instance, symmetric matrix, but that's not very important. A 2 by 2 matrix, real or complex matrix. So those are ordinary numbers. Okay? And I want to define what is exponential of minus theta bar I aig theta ig. Okay? Where I sum over the indices. Of course, this is exponential of minus theta 1 a 1 1 theta bar 1 1 plus theta bar 1 a 1 2 theta 2 plus theta bar 2 a 2 1 theta 1 plus theta bar 2 a 2 2 theta, sorry, theta 2. Okay? Because my matrix is a matrix of the form A11, A12, A21, A22. Okay. So now, why I expand this exponential, this starts to be a bit more complicated because when I expand the exponential, you see that first I get 1. Pardon? You are perfectly right. Thank you. Okay. So once I do that, I found that this is 1. This term gives, when I expand at first order, I get plus A11 theta 1 theta bar 1 plus A12 theta 2 theta bar 1 plus A21 theta 1 theta bar 2 plus A22 theta 2 theta bar 2. Then I get this term, and then I get the term which comes from the products. The term. And then you have two terms. You have a term which is, so the only terms that you will get at second order. There you can have a term which appears at second order because, for instance, you can multiply these terms, which contains theta 1 and theta bar 1, by these terms, which contains theta 2 and theta bar 2. So I can multiply them. And I will get theta 1. So at the end, I can get term which contains theta 1, theta 2, theta bar 1, theta bar 2. You see? And I can get these terms coming from when multiply this term from these terms or this term by these terms. But if I multiply these terms by these terms, for instance, I get 2 theta bar 1, which gives 0. So you see that out of the products, only two of them products, and what they give is A12 A21 minus A11 A22. And that's it. Yes?
Should we divide the second order term by 2?
Yes. No. Because, there is a 2, but in fact, you have two terms which contribute. If you count how they run, so you have 2 times 1 half. So that's it. And therefore, now, what is d theta bar 1 d theta 1 d theta bar 2 d theta 2. of exponential of minus theta bar I A I G theta G. Well, all these terms will give zero because they don't contain all the thetas and theta bar. Only these terms will contribute. You do the calculation. Remember that the thing anti-commute, and what you get at the end is A11, A22 minus A12, A21. And what is this? This is, of course, just the determinant of the matrix. Yes? Pardon? The order is important. Because you see, first I integrate over theta 2. So this gives a minus sign because I have put it here. Then I integrate over theta bar 2. This gives me a minus sign. Then I integrate over theta 1. Oh, that's because there is a minus sign here. No, I think that's correct. I have to check. I think that's correct. I get a minus, then I get a minus. Okay, I will check the sign, but I will be confused. But I think defined properly, you get this number. It depends on how you define the integration, but I think that's the correct one. That might be a sign mistake here. Okay. Anyway, the important thing is this result. It is the determinant of A. If I have not defined properly the integral, I will get minus the determinant of A, but it's just a sign. Okay. And you see that this is a generalization of that. And in fact, this is a general result. For any n, if you have A, an n by n matrix, and if I compute the integral over the products from I equal 1 to n of d theta bar I times d theta I of exponential of minus theta bar I A I G theta I always get the determinant of the matrix. And this comes from the fact that everything anti-commutes. You can prove that quite easily. Okay? So you see those rules, which seems a bit strange of integrating over Grassmann variables, are in some sense a way to compute a determinant out of Grassmann number. And that's different from, this is different from a complex number. Remember, for complex number, what you had is that, sorry. For complex number, what you have here, no, I mixed everything, sorry. That's not what I wanted to do. For complex number, this is mid. Well, okay, let me go back to the. For complex number, integral dz bar I dzi exponential of minus z bar I aig zi gives me determinant of a to the power minus 1 up to a 2 pi normalization factor. But if you define the integral properly, and remember those are complex numbers, so what I call dz bar dz is just dx dy, if z equals x plus I y. So you have two times an ordinary integral over real Gaussian integral. So you see that integrating over Grassmann numbers gives you the determinant, while integrating over ordinary complex number gives you the inverse of the determinant. Yes? Pardon?
Is that not a negative 1/2?
A 1/2? Where? Well, it's just a normalization of A. So up to the normalization, this is a determinant. Okay? And in fact, if you define properly the measure and this for the matrix, you get precisely this. Okay. But it's just a question of normalization of the measure. Pardon? Yeah. No, but here, I'm not sure I understand your objection. Okay.
I think it's answering Nicole's question.
Ah, okay. Okay, we can discuss that later. But nevertheless, well, that's the general feature. Gaussian integrals over ordinary number gives inverse of determinant, and Gaussian integrals over Grassmann numbers gives determinant. Okay? So now, this is already a nice result, but now here comes the interest of real numbers. Now you can define what is expectation value. I can define what is expectation value of theta I, theta bar g. So I can define expectation value of ordinary numbers exactly in the same way. I define that. So this is a coefficient A and a coefficient B. Okay. I define this theta bar I d theta g for all the I. I take exponential minus theta bar I AIG theta G, and I get, I had theta A theta B, and I divide by integral product over I, so D theta bar I D theta I exponential of minus theta bar I AIG theta G, okay? So remember, so this is a definition of what would be an expectation value in the world of Grassmann integration. Yes?
Sorry, is that a theta b bar inside the expectation value?
Pardon?
You're taking the expectation value theta a, theta b bar, right?
Yes.
So should that be a theta b bar in
the... You are right. I'm sorry. Once again, I made a typo. Yes. Thank you. Okay, and you see, this gives the determinant of the matrix A. This will not give the determinant of the matrix A because there is one theta and one theta bar. So you see that when you compute everything here, you will get a product of theta I and theta G where the theta, which contains an A or an B, in the indices are missing. So in fact, you do the calculation and you find that this is in fact the determinant of what is called the minor of A with a sign. Well, you remember if you have a matrix, a big matrix, and you have A and B, the minor is a matrix where you remove the line of the columns. A and B. So it's an n minus 1 by n minus 1 matrix. But this is simply, which tells you that the ratio of the determinant of the minor by the determinant of the matrix itself, it is just the inverse, the AB element, the AB element of the inverse matrix of A. You see? Okay, so what you have to retain is that theta A, theta bar b is equal to this. And this is the same result than for ordinary bosonic integral. It's the Wick theorem, if you want. It is the Wick theorem, but for Grassmann integrals. Okay? But you have a bit, you simply have to be a bit careful. You get that the expectation value of theta times theta bar is equal to in the inverse element of A and B only if the theta is to the left of theta bar. Because in particular, of course, if you have theta bar A, theta B, what you will get is minus one of BA. Okay. But don't forget that the number anti-commutes. Okay. And now, here is the real nice things. Now, let me assume that I compute a theta A, theta bar B, theta C, theta bar D. Be careful, I put it in them, this order. Remember that they're anti-commutes. So I have one theta bar, one theta, and one theta bar. If I had put all the two thetas and then the two theta bar, you will have get a minus sign. Okay. And do the same calculation. I will not do the calculation because it's a bit tedious, but it's just you sit down, you see. And what you found is that, well, you expect that in that case, you have two thetas, you have two thetas, two theta bars. So in fact, you will be removing two things. So, but if you do the calculation, what you find is the following things. You find this is A minus one of AB. So the matrix element AB of the inverse of the matrix A. A minus one of CD. And then you have another contribution, which comes from another of the exponential, which is minus A minus one of AD times A minus one of let me be careful, A minus one of CB. Okay. So this is also Wick theorem. You see that when I compute an expectation value of a product of four variables, it decomposes into the possible expectation value of pairs of thetas. But with a minus sign, because they are anti-commuting, you see? And what does this suggest to you? This is the Wick theorem for fermions. This is the formula you get when you compute expectation value of products of field operator for the Dirac field. That's what you met in the QFT one course. And this has a nice graphical interpretation. The interpretation is that if I write theta A, theta bar B as a propagator going from the thetas to the theta bar, remember, these are different, so you have to specify from where you go. If I represent theta A, theta bar B, theta C, theta bar D, and I apply this theorem, what is this? this is, and I here I write A, B, C, D. This first contribution represents this diagram, and the second contribution represents this diagram, of course, with this order. And you have a minus sign because you have reversed the order. You see? Okay? Minus sign because we have anti-commuting numbers. So, the rule of Gaussian integration for Grassmann numbers, anti-commuting numbers, reproduces the Vick theorem for fermions. Isn't that nice? Yes? Because then, from that, there is an immediate receipt to define a functional integral for the Dirac field. We just apply that. What we do is that for the Dirac quantum field, in fact, the Dirac equations derive from an action. The action for the Dirac field is integral over d4x, psi bar of x, I d slash minus m psi of x. You see? So this is a Lagrangian from which you can derive the density. And in second quantization canonical procedure, this is an operator. This is the conjugate operator, so it's related to the complex to the hermetic conjugate. So in fact, in Dirac quantization, this psi bar of x is psi dagger of x times gamma naught in terms of operators. But this is the action for the Dirac field. Okay? And therefore, idea to define the functional integral is very simple. The idea is that I will just define a functional integral as an integral over psi bar and psi and time exponential of I s Dirac, with s Dirac, this function of psi bar and psi, defined by this formula. Okay. But now I consider that psi is a Grassmann field, namely that in fact psi is the delta of psi x at any value of Minkowski space. Psi of x at any point is in fact a collection of psi alpha of x with alpha going from 1 to 4, the Dirac indices, and I consider that the psi alpha de x are independent Grassmann generators that I can call them, so I can consider that psi alpha de x is some theta of alpha and of x, you see? Similarly, psi bar is a conjugate. Psi bar is a conjugate of psi. Well, almost. So we consider that the psi bar alpha of x are considered as the theta bar alpha of x. And I'm considering a big algebra G, which is the algebra generated by all the those theta alpha x and those theta bar alpha x, instead of having a Gn, which was generated by the theta I and the theta bar I. See, so you consider a big, yes?
When we address the bosonic field in terms of path integrals,
yes.
We started with from a Vick rotation in order to see how the
yes.
path integral is relevant to the bosonic
yes.
field.
Yes.
Why don't we have to do a Vick rotation?
No, because you can do a Vick rotation, but you can define the path integral directly in real time, or you can define it in Euclidean time. That's the same thing here. Here I am doing the functional integral directly in Minkowski space. Minkowski space. Okay? But you can also define fermions in Euclidean space. Those are called Euclidean fermions. And they are very useful when one study gauge theories on a lattice. I'm doing so it makes sense. But at the moment I'm just specifying what's going on?
And so that column that is second from the right, all the way at the bottom, psi bar is the conjugate of psi?
Yes.
Would you mind repeating which kind of conjugate?
It is the conjugate in the this sense. In the sense that it is the theta bar. So to each theta, to each generator of the Grassmann algebra is associated another generator, which is theta bar. And in this big algebra of Grassmann fields over Minkowski space, the conjugate in the sense of the conjugate in the Grassmann algebra of psi of x is psi bar of x.
Perhaps you said this, but just remember, what is the relationship between the Grassmann conjugate and the Dirac conjugate, since each of them have rather precise definitions?
I will come that to that later. At the moment, just take it as a Grassmann conjugate, okay? But there is a slightly different definition, but it's not important for what we are computing, okay? So I defined, I consider that I have a very big Grassmann algebra whose generators are the psi alpha of x and the psi bar alpha of x. You see? So it's an abstract object, but very big. Yes? Yes? It means exactly the same thing that here, when I am writing what is theta bar a theta. This is sum over ig f theta bar I aig theta. So in this big algebra, I have d4x. So you know it's exactly the same. It's just a sum over x. You see, it's simply x is a continuous variable. But this is an element of the Grassmann algebra. You see, it's exactly the same. And of course, so this is, I have big Grassmann field. This is a complicated element of the Grassmann algebra. I take its exponential, and this integral is an integral over this big Grassmann algebra, defined simply by the same kind of things. This d psi bar and psi means, in a formal way, products over x, products of the alpha of d theta bar alpha x times d theta alpha x. You see? Okay? So this is a bit formal definition, but the important thing is that if I do this integration, I know the results from the general results about Gaussian integration. Yes? You mean you have what? Part coherent state or particle state? You mean coherent state? Yes. 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 Yes.
Can we also link these fermionic fields to a basis that, you know, is more familiar, like some single particle state that expands?
That's a very good question, and the answer is yes. In fact, this is I presented just the rule of the calculus. But if you want to think more precisely where it comes from, you go back to quantization of fermions in a very simple non-relativistic case, and there is a concept of coherent state for fermions, which is exactly the same as coherent state for bosons. So there is behind those, this which looks a bit like magic, there is a whole mathematical theory which is connected to the concept of coherent states. Yes, yes, yes. But you don't need, it would take a long time to reach a very simple result. So I show that by just making the analogy, then you get directly the correct tool to compute. But if you do want to do that and justify everything, you can do it. Okay. So, and now we know from this relation and these results what the result it is, because we know that, for instance, this big functional integral Z will be just the determinant, the functional determinant of the Dirac operator with a power on 1. Of course, there is a question of normalization. This determinant is has ultraviolet problem, but formally, the partition function is a determinant instead of being the inverse of the determinant for complex bosonic field. You see? So for Dirac, the partition function for Dirac is this, while the partition function for a charged bosonic scalar field, and I think you have not seen that, so what is this one? Yes, this is the determinant of the Klein-Gordon operator to the power minus 1. And it's power minus 1 because the bosonic scalar field is charged, so it's defined by two fields, phi and phi bar. The phi is complex, so in fact you have two scalar bosons. You see? Okay. So that's the difference between charged bosonic scalar, so complex scalar, and Dirac fermions. But that's not the end, of course, because we know the most interesting part comes from the results for correlation function, because we know that when we compute the expectation value of a psi of x and a psi bar of y by using those rules, we'll get, well, in Fourier transform, 2 pi to the 4 of 4, what do we get? The inverse of the Dirac operator. So we get, if we work everything right, minus I divided by minus P slash minus M minus I epsilon plus E I P X my Y. And it just comes from the fact that this is a matrix element between X and Y of the inverse of the operator, which is in the Dirac action. And we get that just by this rules of integration over Grassmann variables, for the rules which are provided by this Bérezin, because in fact, all those rules of calculation were devised by Bérezin. Just the concept of the algebra was devised by Grassmann, but all those rules of defining what is an integral, what are Gaussians, were devised by Bérezin. So, okay, and you see that this is precisely identical to what you compute in canonical quantization, where you perform the canonical quantization of the Dirac field, and you compute the expectation value in the vacuum of the time ordered product of an operator psi and its conjugate, you get, so this is a propagator, this is a Feynman propagator. For fermions, this is the object which is represented in the by the Feynman rules by this object. And here it's a matrix because you have a P slash, so in fact, those have index, those have Dirac indices, and there is an alpha beta coming here, you see? And here, if I write, this is a matrix element in Dirac indices of this object, you see? And moreover, and now I compute the expectation value of psi psi dagger with four fields. I indeed get that the correct object, which is similar to that, I get this, if this is at x, y, z, t, I get x, y times z times t minus x t times dy. So I get, and I get the correct anticommutation rules and statistics. Pardon?
Of psi of x?
Oh, that's, I'm sorry, I was sketchy. This is, I compute the psi of x, psi of y, psi of z, psi of t. I replace the indices here, a, b, c, d, by points in space-time, because remember, the indices here, instead of being I, are the position in space-time and the Dirac indices. So you get the correct Feynman rules for fermions just out of this this fermionic path integral. So you see. Okay. So this may seem a bit formal, but sometimes this way to write the Feynman rules for fermions as a functional integral just by changing, but remember that the fermionic fields have to be considered as anticommuting numbers instead of commuting ones, is a very, very simple and very direct way to rederive the rules of calculation that you derive in a more complicated way, but perfectly rigorous and equivalent way by canonical quantization. So in some sense, it's a receipt to follow what's going on and to do the calculation without having to recommute operators, etc., at times, time ordering operators and taking into account the anticommutation for fermion operators. This provides you immediately the rule. Okay. And one final remark, this will be important also for gauge series. And I will refer to the lecture of next week. You will see that you have objects when you try to quantize non-abelian gauge series, which behaves like fermions, which are called the Fadeyev-Popov ghosts. You need to quantize some fermionic field, even if you want to quantize properly just gauge fields which are bosons. And so these rules of calculation will play an important role when I shall discuss next week the quantization of gauge theories. So they are much more general than just to quantize Dirac fermions. They appear also in system of statistical mechanics. They are very important in supersymmetry, where you have a lot of fermionic and strange particles, etc. So it's something important to know. Yes?
So the Parkinson-Gore allows us to calculate time ordered operators.
Yes?
What if we don't want to calculate time ordered operators? Or do we always only want to calculate?
By using path integrals, you always compute time ordered operator.
Okay. Are there any cases where we want to compute non time ordered?
You can do that, but you can do that by analytically continuating in time. That's something I started to discuss. Because then, since you seem familiar with what's going on in condensed matter theory a little bit more than perhaps one of them, you have heard about what is the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism. Yes. So there is a way to formulate the Schwinger-Keldysh formalism in the path integral. In fact, I presented it briefly in the first week, but you didn't recognize it properly. So you can do that, but you have to be a bit more. You have to integrate backward in time and play a little bit with what's going on. Okay. Okay, thank you.